This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
All right. So as I was listening to the introduction, I remembered a couple of people have emailed me asking me where we can listen to the live show. And it dawned on me as I was listening to today's introduction that I didn't even include it in the intro and the outro. So I apologize for that. For listeners who'd like to listen to us live, you can listen to it through blogtalkradio.com/beatyourgenes and just select the most recent show on Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And that way you can listen to us live. If you don't listen to us live, you can listen to us through your regular podcast app. So apologies for that, and I'll include that in the next intro from now on. So now that we got that out of the way, whoops.
Yes.
All right. So, got a couple of questions today on certain psychological phenomenon that that I've wondered about since I was, you know, I took a few intro-level psychology classes. I was no genius at all when it came to psychology, but a couple of the classes, they were always just curious to me. And, you know, I saw movies and hostages and medical movies. And so the placebo effect and the Stockholm syndrome were always at the forefront of these. So, Dr. Lyle, we are ready to get the Doug download on either of these. So, Dr. Lyle, is the placebo effect an actual psychological phenomenon or more of a statistical one where it encompasses the factors that you can't quite sort out?
Good question. And it's been a question of the ages, you know, for 50 years. I wouldn't call myself knowledgeable in this arena. I know some things that that probably some people that are talking about this may not know, or they may not mention, or gets overlooked by journalists, et cetera. So let's talk first about what we know. Placebo effects. Let me explain why this gets tricky. What people are thinking placebo effects are things like, well, if I think that there's a pill that helps me, then if I take the pill, there's some neurochemical process of hope that helps me actually improve. You know, regardless of the fact that the pill itself is inert. That's the classic concept of the placebo effect. Now, so we can see how there would be some placebo effects with specifically with respect to hope. They would be short-lived given the fact that if the person's brain is not capable of excreting some hormonal pattern that actually fixes the underlying condition, then obviously it's not going to work. Second of all, you might say, well, now what about in the psychological arena? After all, if everything is just psychological anyway, if someone believes that if they take some pill, it's going to make them less depressed or less anxious, wouldn't this work? Well, the interesting thing is that the medications that are actually designed to do antidepressants don't work. So if those don't work, what do we think a placebo is going to do? So it's going to turn out that the placebo effects have that they have to watch out for. So many of our listeners are sophisticated enough that they will have heard of things like the double-blind placebo-controlled trial in medicine. And you're like, well, why would we have to, if placebo effects were not substantial, why would we have to control for them? Here's why. If you were to take, for example, antidepressants often have as part of their chemical nature, they agitate the nervous system. And so if you have people take an antidepressant, it's not without these immediate effects. Whereas if you take a piece of chalk that's colored like the antidepressant and a yellow pill or whatever the heck it is, then that chalk will not have the same agitating effect. So if you're in a clinical trial, you're somebody that's depressed and, you know, they're telling you, well, you know, there's this new fancy thing that they've been working on at Johns Hopkins and Pfizer that, you know, is supposed to be really, really helpful for depression. And so you're going to be part of the clinical trial. Now, you might get the real pill or you might get the placebo. So, you know, they're going to flip a coin and you'll never know which one you got. Well, you can imagine how problematic this is scientifically. If the yellow pill that has the antidepressant in it agitates the nervous system, it actually does something. So a few days into this, the person's like, oh, cool, I'm in the real drug trial. Okay? And so as a result, they report some positive feelings about this. Like, yeah, I think things are going to get better. So they're going to be more optimistic because they think that they're getting, quote, the real drug. They got something. So when they ran these trials against a placebo control that did not have an agitating effect on the nervous system, then it turned out that the quote, real drugs were doing better than the placebos. However, somebody realized, wait a second, we got a problem. The subjects know what condition they're in. And if subjects know what condition they're in, they will start reporting, you know, on their hope and what they think is happening, et cetera, rather than on anything else. They won't be overwhelmingly happy and excited. It will just start to influence a few subjects, the self-reports of, you know, whether they think they might be getting a little bit better, okay? So so as a result of this, you have to, in your placebo, you have to control so that the placebo has similar noticeable side effects to the drug that you are testing. And so in this case, when they start to give people a little bit of caffeinated, some inert pill theoretically relative to depression, but a little bit agitating to the system, then it turns out that lo and behold, there's no difference in the two groups. Okay, so this is now an appropriate placebo control. That's the issue. So we have to, when you give people something, they may expect that they're going to get better and they may start reporting some effects and everybody can get all excited about it because they're getting something. That doesn't mean they're actually getting better. It just means that their reports are reporting an improvement. You might say, well, isn't that where the rubber hits the road? And isn't that a placebo effect in itself? And the answer is, yeah, you could sort of call it that, except that a month later, there's going to be no placebo effect. In other words, the person's going to stop reporting this bump and how great it is that they think they're doing because they think they're on a drug. So this is why you have to, if you're going to try to test the value of something like a subpsychiatric psychoactive medication like that, you need to have it placebo-controlled. And not only that, the placebo control itself has to mimic the drug, any of the drug's effects that the active drug is having, so that the person clearly is blind and cannot infer what condition they're in. So that's how it is so that's sort of the story. Now, when placebo effects themselves have been measured over the decades, at best, the effect sizes are infinitesimally small, very, very tiny. I think the average effect size of the average placebo will move one side of the cohort, maybe 3 percentile points and at best. And so it's kind of the amount that you would expect, possibly expectations to bump up behind, you know, just a little bit of hope. So in essence, placebos are really inert, and the effect that we're really seeing from placebo is a little bit of short-term hope that comes into the situation. So think about this, for example. I want you to imagine how depressed you are if you're sitting in a hospital bed and they tell you that you have a terminal cancer. Okay, so it'd be a terrible thing, but let's just picture yourself there. And then a doctor comes in and says, you know, they said your cancer is terminal cancer, but it turns out that we have a new treatment and it's 85% chance of fixing it. And so, and when I've actually looked at your chart, I think that your chart has an exceptionally high chance, even better than the 85% chance that we've seen from this new study. Now, do you think that new person's going to feel better? They're going to feel unbelievably better. Now, are they going to be any better? Well, they're not going to be any better physically. And all of that hope doesn't magically cause their endocrine system to somehow start fighting the cancer better, and they're miraculously happier, and now it's going to turn out that there's a 5% increased likelihood of their survival. Never going to happen. Okay, so so placebo effects are essentially non-existent. They are short-term, extremely modest little effects. They can sometimes be larger if we don't control carefully for conditions, and we wind up leaking expectations of effects to clients or patients, and they wind up marking on the little sheet, you know, a little higher, and it turns out that it's all statistically significant and somebody gets all excited about it. So this is the story of the placebo. The notion that people are thinking about placebos, which is that the placebo itself somehow miraculously causes there to be, you know, neurological and endocrinological changes in the body that now miraculously start curing whatever ill it is that the person was seeking the medicine for, because it magically starts to figure out how to do that, because somehow the hope is healthier and so forth. That turns out to not be true. So that is the story of the placebo effect, and the fact that even though it is a non-effect, it can be a pesky and important issue to control for in short-term studies because of the self-reports of individuals. You won't see that, for example, you won't see these kind of effects in something that has more objective measurements, for example, high blood pressure. So you could have someone go to some guru and learn how to sit in the lotus position and have them work on their high blood pressure, and they really think it's helping because they can be far more relaxed, and they can get into a deep state of relaxation. But when we're going to measure their blood pressure changes at the doctor's office or in the study, there will be no effect, and that's because meditation is not going to reduce blood pressure. So the no relaxation training, no cognitive behavioral therapy, nothing. Okay, so exercise is going to have almost no effect. So what will have an effect on blood pressure? Exactly what we would think would have an effect on blood pressure, which is to actually deal with the underlying problem that is driving high blood pressure. Two things would be clogging of people's arteries through their diet, or also excessive sodium in the diet that is putting too much pressure on the kidneys, and therefore the blood volume is too high, and therefore there's essentially more fluid in the system and the pressure goes up, just the pressure in a water hose goes up if you turn on the water higher. So what will cause a dramatic change in blood pressure will be a dietary change. So 20 years ago, John McDougall showed that a change from a conventional diet to his diet for in 10 days dropped the blood pressure on average 17 over 13 points. Meditation is zero. Exercise is about 3. Weight loss is a couple of points per, you know, half a kilogram or whatever it is, maybe a point per kilogram. Very, very, very small effect sizes for weight loss, et cetera. So when you look through the effect sizes, what you're going to see is what? Sodium. And the biggest effect size ever demonstrated in any scientific literature on weight loss was water-only fasting. So water-only fasting is the ultimate method for detoxing the system, allowing the kidneys to catch up, detox the blood of excess sodium, and then drive down the blood volume to the point where people lose a bunch of water weight very quickly, and their blood pressure comes down, all the pressure comes off the kidneys. Alan Goldhammer and I demonstrated this, 15, 20 years ago in a study we did showing an average effect size of 37 over 13 points, by far the largest effect size ever shown. This is incredibly, the reviewers at the New England Journal of Medicine, number one, didn't believe us. And number two, they then wrote and said, how do you know it wasn't a placebo effect?
Oh, God. And this is where the medications are actually only 12 points, 12 over 6 points.
Yeah, the beauty of this is that I have no idea what the moron on the other end of this review was thinking. So if there could be a placebo effect that could cause a 37-point drop in blood pressure, why aren't they using it clinically? Okay. Where do they have any evidence that there's anything like that that could ever have such an effect? They don't have anything. So that's why they use blood pressure medication, which puts pressure on various systems to drive blood pressure down, and it'll knock it down on average about 12 over 6 points. So anyway, yeah, the long answer to this story is placebo effects are nothing to put any hope in for anything, and they are pesky in terms of scientifically about depending upon what our dependent measures are. We have to be careful to not get tricked into thinking that something is working when in effect we've just cued our subjects or our patients into thinking something could happen, and therefore they are feeding us what's known as a demand characteristic. In other words, we're pulling this out of them behind some hope and expectation and essentially wanting to give us good news. And thirdly, if you actually have high blood pressure and you want to get rid of it, don't meditate. Come to Nathan Gershfeld's Fasting Escape in Southern California and take yourself a time out and have him supervise your short water fast and refeed you with healthy, low-sodium food, and you'll come out of there as if you've taken 10 years burden off your kidneys and you'll be healthy. All right. Now we'll move.
Thank you very much
All
for
right,
the endorsement again.
Let's move on.
Yeah, it seems like the water fasting in the study that you and Dr. Goldhammer published, what would that be? The opposite of a placebo where they believe – where it does work, but they believe it doesn't work, right? What do we
call
that?
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I don't know what we call that. We call that – I don't know who phrased this term. We call that a counterintuitive result, but – I don't know who phrased the term, but I quoted the late Carl Sagan, who said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that makes sense. That's a reasonable proposition for anybody who's making an extraordinary claim. We believed that water fasting is going to be one of the most effective things that anybody could ever do to heal themselves. And we demonstrated that with the leading associated correlate of death and disability in the United States, which would be high blood pressure. And we showed the largest effect size ever shown. And we no medications, everybody off all their medications. And we just essentially let the body heal and unwind according to mechanisms built into the genetic code to do exactly that. And so, we believe we have extraordinary claims to make, and we believe we have extraordinary evidence. And now we're getting many major researchers coming to us to want to document and observe what it is that we're seeing. All right, enough of that. On we go.
All right, fantastic. Well, speaking of locking people in a place and fasting them, now we come up to the next question, which is Stockholm Syndrome.
Right.
So, Dr.
Yes.
So, Dr. Lyle, how much truth is there behind Stockholm Syndrome? And this listener is asking specifically the idea that women were frequently kidnapped by males of other villages, and the more compliant women were more successful genetically.
Oh, you got to love our listeners. What's beautiful about evolutionary psychology, once you get the hang of it, it can be a little bit like a Wild West frontier. So everybody starts seeing possible. It's like a new heuristic. It's a new tool in people's thinking toolbox, and they start speculating about evolutionary processes all over the place. And sometimes a wild, scattered spark of genius, and then the rest of it, a bunch of people selling snake oil, and you know how else would we have expected it? This had nothing to do with a steady diet of women being kidnapped from somebody else's village, and et cetera, et cetera. Now that has nothing to do with this. The Stockholm syndrome had to do with a bank robbery in Stockholm a few decades ago, and the captives surprised authorities when they wouldn't testify or speak out against their captors after it was all over. And if you think about this, so it was kind of this bizarre thing, and a lot of it was made of it, and people wrote books about it, and you know, a lot of psychodynamic, beard pulling by the psychodynamic folks, like, well, they identified with it, or whatever the hell that they identified with them. Whatever the hell that means, okay? Let's break this down to straight, honest evolutionary thinking. The reason why anybody does anything is they're running a cost-benefit analysis. So let's now look at why it is I might not speak out against a bunch of dangerous psychopaths that held me captive in a bank. Okay, now let me think here. Let me stroke my beard, which I cannot grow. And let's see if we can think through. Okay. All right. Let me see now. Okay. There he is in the courtroom. That son of a bitch who held a gun at my face and was yelling and was a terrifying psychopath who could have easily killed me, et cetera. All right. So here I am now. And now we're in court. And that son of a bitch is still alive. Now, what could I do? Now, who could I side with? The judge and the prosecutor, and everybody wants me to say these negative things, okay? But that son of a bitch is still out and alive. Now, I look at that, and I say, okay, let me think about this. I got a couple of choices. If I say bad things about him, there's a statistical increased likelihood that he'll be locked up. If I say good things about him, if they lock him up, great, no problem, he's locked up. But if they don't lock the son of a bitch up, and I said bad things about him, that's bad. That could be very bad for me. And so in that case, maybe it's in my best interest to actually say perfectly pleasant things about this guy, even though he did bad things, and I damn well know he did bad things. So I think that that's a little healthier understanding of what may happen in a few cases. The quote Stockholm syndrome, I don't believe, is a widely supported phenomenon in social psychology. I don't believe that there's any strong evidence that this is a common phenomenon. I think it's a relatively uncommon phenomenon that surprised people in Sweden. On this, with a few of these people were essentially probably intimidated. I don't think that they, quote, identified and joined the captors' village or thought positively about them. No, I think that this was a slick, self-interested CB that they ran. And in order to be credible, I mean, the nervous system is clever enough to actually put on a pretty good show and possibly even confuse the person themselves a little bit. And in order to essentially make a credible public display so that the son of a bitch on the other side, there was a psychopath waving a gun around that one day might be free won't be coming after me for any reason. So I think that that's the quote Stockholm syndrome, and I think it's much better explained through a very simple cost-benefit analysis.
Wow, phenomenal.
All right.
All right. So now we turn the ship around a little bit, and one
okay.
of our listeners has a situation.
Hold on a second.
Oh,
hold yep. on. I gotta say one more thing.
Okay.
Alan Goldhammer has said that sometimes people, when people leave True North and they start preaching the virtues of healthy living, that it's been suggested that this is nothing other than the Stockholm syndrome. They've been taken captive. So if you come to Nate's place at Fasting Escape and it turns out that you're preaching healthy living after this, just beware. Could be the Stockholm syndrome. Or you've been... Okay. All right.
And to experience this on your own, you can visit www.fastingescape.com.
Yes. There it is. There it is again. All right. Okay. All right. Let's go
on. Fantastic. All right. Well, one of our listeners has a situation with her son. So, dear Dr. Lyle, my son is 26 years old, and he's still living with us. He quit college in his fourth year due to a mental breakdown and then came back home to live with us. Well, that was 4 years ago, and he still can't get his life together. He's got a full-time job that pays minimum wage, but that isn't nearly enough to pay for all of the expenses. We have to pay for his occasional car repairs, his car insurance, his health insurance. He's been seeing the same therapist for the past 4 years, and he's made little progress, and he's still angry. He has one or two friends, but views most people as, quote, shitheads, and can be overbearing when interacting with people. In a word, he's pretty disagreeable. Consequently, he's extremely lonely. When his father and I make suggestions on how he might improve his life, he becomes angry and makes excuses. I sense that he's afraid of life. How can we help our son become independent and build lasting friendships? Signed, a concerned mom.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. well, I can tell you what I think the problem is, but of course, in any given situation, there could be subtle details that could be important, and it would change my mind if I were to learn about what they were. So I began my thoughts about this with the fact that he had some kind of a breakdown, and I don't know what that means. And so I don't know what he went through, whether we've got some, you know, schizophrenogenic genes located in there, and that he's actually very odd interpersonally. And even though he'd gone to college, and so he has some IQ in there, but possibly above average IQ that could buffer him from some of the dire consequences of some odd social characteristics. It's possible that we have somebody that actually has some serious mental handicaps that are working against him. Okay. So if that's true, then I wouldn't necessarily give them the advice that I'm about to give. So I say those things just because they use the word breakdown. I don't know what that means. I don't know what this young man experienced and what sort of essentially psychiatric susceptibilities that we're sitting on. Now, let's suppose that the breakdown we talked about was just being overwhelmed, irritated, a lot of negative feedback from everybody, didn't see the point of school, and that what we have is sort of an angry, exhausted, frustrated, disagreeable young person. Different issue. And the reason why this might be what it is that we're seeing, and two reasons. Number one, it is statistically more likely that this is what we're seeing than the other. And also that he's held a full-time job for apparently quite a while. And if you hold a full-time job, even though you can be pretty dysfunctional holding a full-time job, most highly dysfunctional people are not going to hold a full-time job for a long period of time. So if he's held a full-time job for quite a while, he's been stable in that job, that would speak to the likelihood that we actually have a fundamentally stable situation psychiatrically. So when I say psychiatrically, what I'm really talking about is major mental illness. You know, these are genetically mediated problems like the schizophrenic type of things, things related to that that are odd, schizoid, also things like bipolar disorder, et cetera. So that these are these sort of major psychiatric, very angry people a lot of times can actually be paranoid, and they can be quite functional and quite intelligent, and they can hold down jobs, but they can have a paranoid streak, and they're angry and suspicious, et cetera. So this is a long-winded reason why I'm giving a long-winded caveat is because what I'm about to say is fairly dramatic and aggressive relative to what the other therapist is going to do. And this is how I see things in most cases. So mostly what we see is a 26-year-old who's pretty smart, capable of holding a full-time job, who is angry, which means he feels like he's being treated unfairly by various and sundry individuals, not so dysfunctional that he gets into it too badly at work as much to lose his work. So he can temper this down. But he's angry at his parents, I think, and he's also his parents see that he needs help financially for this and needs help financially for that. So they're paying for this and they're paying for that. Now, he's living at home. So let's just do a little bit of math here. So the math is if he's living at home with his parents and he's working full time, the last I knew, I don't know what the lowest minimum wage is in the United States. Nate, do you have any idea?
I believe the federal minimum wage, I actually don't know, but I could probably Google it faster than my memory can recall. No. The federal minimum wage is $7.25.
Okay, so it's possible he's making $7.25 an hour. So if he's making $7.25 an hour, he's grossing about $1,200 or $1,300 a month, which means he's taking home, you know, $1,000 or $1,100 a month. Why he's not paying for his own car insurance and why he's not paying for his own dental fillings and why he's not paying for his own food, et cetera, and why he's not ponying up $300 or $400 a month for rent is beyond me, okay? And so what we want is we would want to make life at home financially uncomfortable. And we want to make life in general financially uncomfortable. And the reason why we want to make life financially uncomfortable is that he needs to feel his poverty. Poverty is the result of a few things potentially. It's the result of laziness. It's the result of ignorance. And it's the result of, you know, very bad luck and bad circumstances. In his case, he's probably ignorant in the sense that he doesn't know what to do and hasn't learned effective skills in order to be worth more money than he's making. Okay? So that's fine. As long as he's got some brains, he's capable of learning those skills. Now, he's also going to be, as an energy conservation device, he's not particularly motivated to go to the hustle to learn those skills as long as he has no material deprivation. So this is why he needs to be paying for his own food and his own rent and his own house and his own car insurance, okay? He essentially needs to be footing his own bills, which is suddenly going to make him highly anxious, all upset. It's all not fair. It's no problem. This is called an adjustment. Now, it means that he's going to have to live in less posh circumstances that he's in. He's going to have to rent a room in somebody's house because that's going to be what he's going to be able to afford as he pays for everything else. Now, I wouldn't necessarily land them all at once, and I wouldn't land it all in 30 days, but I'd let them know. I'd give them like a 90-day lead time. And if you're his mom and you're worried and you just can't be that tough on him, you could be pretty tough on him. You can be a lot tougher on him than you would think. Now, at this point, I like people to remember that the job in the Stone Age was you worked until you made sure that you were safe and fed. So you didn't decide that you were going to just work 8 hours. So we got people now that think if they work over 40 hours a week, they're going to die. Okay. The truth is that a typical animal works an awful lot more than 40 hours a week. So if you want to do this, get yourself a beehive and notice that those things are working every day and they're working all day long. So there's nothing will kill this kid if he has to have one full-time job for 40 hours and then he has to have another part-time job where he works one day a week at the car wash and pulls in another, $60-$70 a day, 4 days a month, and another $200 or $300. Suddenly, miraculously, we can pay for more. And so material deprivation is the incentive for animals to get moving. And not only do they get moving if they're a human or any other animal, they try to move as efficiently as they can to get as many resources as they can per muscular contraction. And so that's called getting a skill. Okay, so suddenly he's going to be, if he's got a brain in there, he's 26 years old, was possible to be college educated, he has a genius inside that head for energy conservation. And he will figure out what does the market want, i.e., where do they pay the highest and what do I have to do to get there? Right now, all he has to do is bitch and demonstrate his anger to his parents and then miraculously, like a genie out of a bottle, okay, here comes the resources. This is because he's got parents that feel themselves over a barrel relative to the most expensive thing in the world, which is a gene copy. And they're very, very worried that this young man is in trouble and they're not sure how to help him and they're paying for his therapy for the last 4 years. A new style of therapy, if in fact we don't have a compromised psychiatric individual, which I don't think we do, but I couldn't say this. Obviously, you can't diagnose people without ever even knowing anything about their background. But the sound of this sounds to me like probably what we have is a disagreeable / entitled young man, just by nature, through no fault of his own. He's got himself a 70-30 chip in there, and he's irritated that he doesn't get more from the world given his efforts. He's got a lot of company. Okay, so this doesn't make him unusual. It just makes – he can make life difficult. And so what we want to do is we want to bring him into adulthood at a reasonably fast pace so that he suddenly learns that he's going to have to hustle. And we learn something else. Some of the anger that he is displaying – and he's displaying towards the parents, he doesn't even know this. But this could be a very substantial component of the young man's anger and frustration. I believe I'm getting the name right, and if I don't, I'm sorry. I believe it was the psychiatrist Eric Byrne, probably 50 years ago, talked about three communication styles and gave birth to what's known as transactional analysis. Somebody could look it up while we're talking, but I believe that was Eric Byrne. I could be wrong. But transactional analysis had a big heyday in the 1960s and 70s as people could see the truth in it and then tried to develop like a whole psychological psychobabble theory around it. And, it was kind of like, a pretty nice bolt on a 747. In other words, it's nice. It's a nice piece, but it ain't the whole ship. So otherwise, it's not some big theory of psychology, but it's significant enough. So let me describe, I don't actually know that there's been any science on it, but as a clinician, it's very obvious that this is true. What Byrne described was that people's communications go in a few very simple patterns, that they're essentially taking either the role of a parent, a child, or an adult. And so he described transactions, i.e. you could analyze the transactions between people. They could be adult to adult. So you go up to a clerk at the counter and you say, where's the nearest Starbucks? And the clerk says, two blocks down to the left. That's adult to adult communication. Here's a child coming up to some guy's late. He's like, oh my God, I just got to get to my Starbucks. So where's the Starbucks? Okay. Now the clerk recognizes that this person's in this panic needy mode. That's childlike mode. And so now they're, what's happening is it's forcing them into a parental role. Okay. And a parental role by its very genetic predisposition is altruistic. And so now they take a parental, like, relax now, let me help you. Now suddenly we get a whole nother level of effort and energy and potentially altruistic, in other words, a sacrifice of their own energy towards this individual that's in the child role. Now, children are designed with manipulative repertoire in order to get resources from big people, particularly their parents. And so they make interesting noises to get them. And so some of those noises are called whining and crying. Okay. Those are methods to signal to the adults that they are out of control. There's important resources that they want and they need parental help to get those resources. Okay. Now it's going to turn out that there's another manipulative technique that sits inside of people and that you'll also see very often in children. And that is that you will see anger. So anger is another side to the whining and crying. The whining and crying is, you know, it's not fair and I need more resources and I need your help. Anger is I'm not being treated fairly and I'm pissed off and I'm going to retaliate. Okay. So this young man is essentially signaling his anger and he's signaling in and around his parents. And when his parents make suggestions about how to be more independent, i.e., you know, pick up your own boots, pick up your life by your bootstraps, put out a little bit more energy. Maybe you need to do this and do that to become more effective. No, he didn't want to hear any part of it. And so this is, you'll see children do this. Children will oscillate between anger and tears, okay? So you'll watch them. It's very interesting to watch them. Sometimes they're frustrated. They'll start crying. If that doesn't work, the nervous system will assess that it's not working and then switch to plan B, which is anger, okay? And then if that doesn't work, they'll switch back to pathetic mode. So they will oscillate. So this young man is going to – he's sitting in anger mode, which is working. It's continuing to have the parents provision him. What we're going to do, what I would do, is I would essentially gently but firmly tell him, essentially adult to adult, guess what? You're a full-fledged adult now. You're 26 years old. You're extremely bright and competent, and you've demonstrated your ability to, you know, do solidly in the adult world by holding down a full-time job. It's now time for us to really step out of your life in a big way and really let you run your own show. Okay, that's how we do it. So we're going to do this, and 90 days from now, you need to find your own place, take care of this bill, take care of that bill. We'll still take care of this bill and that bill, but you are now going to take care of this that you're not taking care of now. Okay? All right. Well, the first thing we're going to see is a bunch of anger. But then after the anger dies down and that doesn't work, then we're going to see the tears and the whining. Oh, but Mom, I just don't know that I could do it. Okay? So now he's going to slip into that mode to try to yank on the parental altruism. Don't buy it. Okay? Just keep the conversation right adult to adult. I understand you're anxious about that, but you know what? We got a lot of confidence in you, and we believe that you're very resourceful, and we believe that you can manage this. And if we didn't, we wouldn't push you to do it, and we wouldn't be doing this, but we really actually have a great deal of confidence that you can do it, i.e. adult to adult. You're not banging on my altruistic chip. and I'm not buying it. It can be pleasant and firm, but adult to adult. They get it. Their human source code will read what's happening. And what's very interesting when you do this is that you can shut people's anger and tears down very, very quickly. A psychodynamic therapist would say you've repressed them and we haven't let them express their feelings and process it. It's like, no. No. What we did was we shifted them to adult communication style, and we've shut down a manipulative strategy that the individual was running totally unconsciously. And along with the manipulative strategy that they're running, they are actually having the feelings. Okay, they're not like making this up. They didn't learn this or plot it out with a protractor and a fine point pencil. No, this is genetic. This is, it's like, how can I get resources? Well, I can cry. Okay, we'll try that. Oh, I'm going to get angry. I'm going to try that. No, this is what they're doing. They're a jukebox in there. They're hitting strategies. So this young man, by his very nature, hits the anger strategy. But once we stonewall that strategy and show him the new deal, he's going to hit the tear strategy. I think there's an extremely high likelihood that we're going to see that. When he hits that strategy, be prepared. Okay, it's like, no, don't buy it. You keep sending him adult-to-adult signals, and you'll find once he finds that strategy doesn't work, the kid will take a deep breath and realize, okay, I guess I got to do it. And he will still probably signal some anger as he's going out the door as a last-ditch effort to try to get some resources. But once he's on his own and has to fire up his creativity and his energy, he will discover a stream of self-esteem and increased confidence as he is successful at managing these challenges and a better life. So that is the strategy that we use for this situation, and I've done that many times and very successfully. All right.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully this son doesn't have Stockholm syndrome and he can't leave the house. Just kidding.
All right.
Well, we had a caller on hold. So caller, just call back next week and we'll get to you. It was the 404 number. So just call back next week and we'll be able to talk to you. So Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. As always, we love it. And we'll look forward to speaking with you next show.
Fantastic. We'll see you all then.
Oh, and the outro music is not playing, so I'm just going to hum it right now. Okay. Do, 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 do. Oh, here we go. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.